It is May the 16th, and we are finishing up Parashas Vayigash. We are on page 266, and we're going to start with Pasuk Chaf Aleph 21, and we're going to go to the end of the Parashah Mitzvah. So the Torah here is giving us the system of how Yosef set up the giving out of the food and with the Egyptians, and how he essentially made the Egyptian culture into a everybody becoming serfs to the king, which now is going to be explained in more detail. But because they ran out of money and they ran out of livestock, so they became slaves, both their bodies and their land, slaves to Paro. And we pointed out last time that Yosef was doing this in order to make it that his brothers and his family, who he knew would become slaves, would not be that much different than everybody else. So the Torah says, "Ve'es ha'am he'evir oso le'arim," and the nation, he moved them to cities. "Mikzegvul Mitzrayim atkatzehu," from the edge of the boundary of Mitzrayim until its edge. So he moved everybody all around. As Chazal tell us, he took people out of this city and put them in that city, and no one ended up living in the same city that they had been living in before. We pointed out last time one reason for this. We've already mentioned one just now, is that when his brothers would become slaves, everybody would become slaves, so no one would be considered to be a native. Everybody is a transplant. So it takes away the sense of being strangers that his brothers have right now. Actually, this is even before they become slaves. We also pointed out last time that it takes the people away from their claim that they really own the land. Once they gave the land away to Paro, so it's possible that the person who's sitting on the same land that he owned and his family owned for many generations, so after some time he'll start to claim that he never did give it up to Paro, that it's really his family land. So by moving people around, then he made it clear that no one owned the land. So that was Yosef's second goal in moving them around. Picture what it's like. I mean, he took people. Imagine just being picked up from our homes and being moved elsewhere, not necessarily to inferior housing, like, God forbid, like the ghettos of Europe, like what was done then. But let's say it's just to be moved to other very similar types of neighborhoods, but in other cities where you're totally unfamiliar with things, how things go on over there. You're unfamiliar with the climate. You're unfamiliar with the layout of the city, with terrain. You're unfamiliar with where things are. It's disconcerting. So everybody became transplants. Chaf Beis 22. Rak admasa kohanim lo kana. Only the land of the kohanim, of the priests, he did not acquire. Why not? Now the Torah tells us clearly why not. Ki chok la kohanim meis paro. For there was a portion given to the kohanim directly from Paro. V'achlu es chukam ha'shana asam lahem paro. They ate their portion that Paro gave to them. Al kein therefore lo machru es ad masam. They never sold their land. It's clear from the Torah that Yosef had wanted to enslave the priests just like everybody else. He had no intention of there being an exception to his rule. But Paro intervened and prevented Yosef from imposing the same rules on the Kohanim, because Yosef didn't have power over the people just to declare them as slaves. The way he did it was that they didn't have any food, they needed to buy, so they paid for it with their land and with themselves, and they ended up owning nothing. But with the Kohanim, because they were given free food, a free lunch, so therefore there was no way that Yosef could acquire the Kohanim. So Paro protected the Kohanim. Now this is very, very significant for us as well, which we'll see in a moment. Yes?
When you say Kohanim, I thought that it meant Pharaoh's priests.
Mm-hmm.
Our priests?
No. The priests of his Avodah Zarah, of his deities, of his idolatries. Right. Vayomer Yosef El Ha'am. Yosef said to the nation, Behold, I have acquired you and your land today to Paro. Hey lochem zera, here is seed. Uzratem esadama, you shall plant the land. V'ayaba tivuos, it will be in the tivuah, which means the grain. How does it say it over here? At the ingathering of the harvest. Okay, the harvest. Uzratem chamishis, the Paro, you'll give a fifth to Paro. 20% goes to Paro. V'arba hayados, and the other 4/5, ye lochem will be for you. L'zera hasadeh, for planting the field, and to eat, for your eating, and to feed those who are in your homes, and to feed your children. So Yosef set up a system of taxation where 20% went to Paro. Now it's unfair to call this taxation, because taxation suggests that you own everything, and then you give a portion of what you own to the government in order that the government should be able to provide whatever services the government provides. But this is not taxation. This was actually benevolence. Really, everything was owned by the crown. And Yosef could have said 100% goes to the king, and then the king will give to you whatever he pleases. But instead, he said, you only have to give 20%. The crown will allow you to keep 80% of whatever you grow. You only need to give 20% to the crown. Vayomru hecha yisanu. So they said, let us live, or you have saved our lives. This is a statement of gratitude. Nimtachin b'ni Adoni, we should find favor in the eyes of our master. Vayinu avadim l'faro, we will be slaves to Paro. Vayosem osa Yosef l'chok anayom azal admas mitrayim. And Yosef made it as a law till this day on the land of Egypt, l'faro l'chomesh, that a 20%, a fifth, goes to Paro. Rak admas ha-kohanim b'vadam, only the land of the kohanim alone, lo ha'isa l'faro, did not go to Paro. V'yeshev Yisrael b'eretz Mitzrayim b'eretz Goshen, and Yisrael dwelled in the land of Mitzrayim, in the land of Goshen. V'yeochazu va, they took hold of it. V'yifru v'yirbu ma'od.
What does it say till this day?
Well, what do you say?
The day they leave Egypt.
Okay.
Those imposed as the statute.
What is the simple meaning of until this day?
Till now. That's what it sounds like.
That's what the words say. So the Torah is saying that as we are reading it today, in the year 2010, this rule still exists. Whether people keep it or not is questionable, but that the rule still exists.
Meaning if Jews were in Egypt?
He didn't make it for Jews. He made it for Egyptians. Now, we don't know that Egyptians are in Egypt. Remember, Sancheirev moved everybody around. Now, it does say that the Pasuk says that the Egyptian nation would come back to Egypt. The Rambam writes that all nations have been moved around, the exception of the Egyptians, where they are, but even though they were moved, but they came back later. But today's Egyptians, we don't know if they're actual Egyptians or not. But either way, the rule was set for Egyptians, not for the Jews. Okay, let's see if we can come back to that after we go through this a little bit more carefully. Now, first of all, before we talk about the Kohanim, which is very important, let's make some observations here about this rule that Yosef set of 20%. Now again, remember, it's difficult to call this taxation. This is a gift from the crown of 80%, while 20% goes to its rightful owner, which is the king. Now, Yosef says, he makes it a 20% rule. There is a medrash that says, based on this rule that Yosef set up, that we derive from here that one should give 20% of their earnings to tzedakah, to charity. that 20% you give away and you keep 80%. Why would that be learned from here? Obviously, Yosef is not talking about the mitzvah of tzedakah, he's talking about what happened to the Egyptians. But we learn it from here because think of the parallel, and let's understand this carefully. We tend to think of the money that we earn as our money, and then the government taxes us, and we are obliged to pay the government the money that it imposes upon us to pay them. That's a tax liability. And officially, that's supposed to result in the government then providing services for us. Protection, different types of perhaps health services, etc. Mm-hmm. Whether that's what's being done or not, one can debate that. But that's officially the way it's supposed to work. That's fine in a representative democracy as we have today. But in a system where not only is it a monarchy, but the king has officially acquired everything, then, as we've been stressing, it's all owned by the king, and he is, in his benevolence, giving up 80% of what is rightfully his. When we work, or even if we don't work, we just earn money, whatever way we earn money, we know, as Jews, that money is not ours. That money is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem has given us a gift, and He gives it to us for the purpose of our being able to have our own livelihood, and we should be able to survive. The way that He set it up is that He said that you take 80% and give me back 20%. Now, He doesn't need money, but give me back in the form of do what I say to do with the money, with the 20%, give it to the poor, give it to the needy. And it's almost a perfect example or similarity to what's going on over here. Now, you'll ask, but we know that we give Meiser, we give 10% of our earnings to tzedakah. So the truth is, and I've pointed this out before, that the way that it says it in Shulchan Aruch is that one is to give 20% of what they earn to tzedakah, and then it says if one cannot afford 20%, then one should not give less than 10%. Today we generally give 10%, perhaps a little bit more. It's rare that a person gives 20% because it's too difficult to give that much money. But officially, that is the way it says it in Shulchan Aruch. If a person can't afford it, that would be the appropriate amount of tzedakah to give. I don't suggest that anybody should do it unless they really are living very comfortably, because most of the time, most people cannot afford to give that much money to tzedakah. There are other parallels here that we learn regarding tzedakah. For example, in Pasuk Kav Daled, verse 24, V'hoyaba tivuos, will be at the harvesting of the grain, the ingathering of the harvest. You'll give 20% to Paro. What happens if a person has a bumper crop and he harvests the wheat or the grain and then leaves it in his field to dry in bundles with intention of coming back later to gather in the harvest? In the meantime, a tragedy occurs and the grain is destroyed, stolen, rotted, whatever, flooded, whatever problem may have happened, but he never actually gathers in all the grain that he harvested. How much miser does he give from the grain? Now remember, miser from grain is different than it is from earnings. When we talk about giving tzedakah, we call it miser. That's not really what the Torah is talking about when it says miser, 10% of the crop. But that crop that one has to take miser from, has to take the tithes from, how much does he take? Does he take 10% of the original harvest or 10% of what he actually gathered in later? He gathered in later. That's what he takes the 10% from. Similarly, when it comes to tzedakah, when we calculate our 10 or 12 or 15 or 20%, whatever it is that we're giving from our earnings, it is after it is gathered in, which means that you deduct for taxes, income taxes, you deduct for business expenses, and then after the deductions, then you calculate Meiser. So if a person officially makes $100,000 a year, but they have to subtract a nice amount of that for taxes, plus they have their business expenses in, let's say, travel to and from work, for example. Let's say they're paying off student loans, which is a business expense, or other such expenses.
The mortgage.
The mortgage is not a business expense, okay. But the lease is.
The lease is.
But not the mortgage of the home. After subtracting all of that, then he ends up with $52,000. Then his Meiser bill would not be $10,000, which is 10% of $100,000. It would be $5,200, which is 10% of $52,000. That's the way it would work. It's after subtracting. Mm-hmm. Now, one could have a question of which types of expenses are valid deductions from Meiser. In many ways, we will mimic the tax code, but in many ways, we will not. And if one is not sure, of course, one should consult their LOR, their local Orthodox rabbi. But what that would be the thing to do if one is not sure which types of things can be deducted. Certain expenses can be deducted pre-Meiser, which the IRS would not accept as a deduction. Other types of things the IRS would accept as a deduction, which halakha will not accept as a deduction pre-Meiser. So if you're not sure, then you ask. But essentially, it's the same type of idea where we deduct first and then calculate the Meiser.
They're farming the land for Paro. So when they gather in the harvest, they give Paro his 20%. So
correct.
He's trusting them to...
Correct. What was the enforcement? I don't know. And was there an IRS of sorts that went around to enforce and make sure that they were giving what they were supposed to give and keeping records of how much people harvested? I don't know.
Probably they had a granary, and the granary probably had
most likely
weighed everything.
Most likely, it was probably several granaries. But yeah, most likely that's what it was. Something along those lines. That's what you would expect.
Do we also learn from him, Orla and other, like reversing, the gleanings and not to be...
Not from here. That's later on. The Torah expresses that explicitly. Yeah.
Usually when you hear about the past, you hear about, the pharaohs or kings that are kind of greedy. Mm-hmm. Why would the pharaoh accept 20% and not 80%? What makes this pharaoh different?
Well, first of all, it was Yosef who...
But I'm saying, pharaoh is the one that say yay or nay.
We don't find that Paro overrode Yosef in anything other than giving to the priests. We don't find any other thing in the entire story that Paro decided to pull rank on Yosef. He was certainly scared of him. That we pointed out before, because remember that at the beginning of the famine, the Egyptians, all of their grain that they stored up went bad. Mm-hmm. Only Yosef stayed fresh. So Paro got scared, and he told the people, listen to whatever Yosef tells you to do, because he obviously decreed that all of your grain or all of our grain should spoil, except his. So maybe he'll decree that we should all die. So they were afraid of Yosef. They felt Yosef had, if not supernatural powers, he was connected upstairs in a way that they weren't. And they were afraid of him.
So what made a difference between the priests?
Okay, so we're going to talk about the priests in a moment.
Okay.
There's a lot to talk about on that. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The question is, why did Paro have respect for Kohanim?
Okay, so that we're going to get to in a moment. I don't think it's fear. We'll see in a moment. We're going to discuss that in depth. So let's just first finish off this part of the discussion, and then we'll talk about that specifically. The Medrash says, very interesting, in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23. It's an interesting language of the Torah. I'm going to read it again. Vayomer Yosef al ha'am, Yosef said to the nation, Hein kanisi etzchem hayom ve'asat matzchem l'faro, I have acquired you today and your land for Paro. Hei lochem zera, here is for you seed. Hei lochem zera. I'm looking at the English for the translation they use.
Here is seed for you.
Here is seed for you. That word, hey. Hey lochem zera. That's a funny word to use. It's not common. Usually it's hinei lochem. Here it is, or behold it is. Hey lochem is unusual. Uzratem es ha'adama, and you will seed the land. You'll plant the land. The Medrash says, hey lochem zera. What do you think of when you hear the word hey?
Hey,
you. Hey, okay, good. H-A-Y. You said H, like H-U-H-E-Y.
Like a Gemara saying, ha. Huh.
What is that? Ha, huh, like surprise. Okay?
You think of God. Hey, I think of God.
Why do you think of God?
There's something about the letter hey.
The letter hey.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you think of the letter hey. That is, the way the letter hey is spelled is exactly the way it says it here. Hey lochem zera. It's almost like saying, the letter hey, the letter hey, for you and for you as seed. The Medrash says, if you'll recall, way back in Parshas Lech Lecha, that Avraham Avinu, his original name was Avram, and when he was Avram, he was unable to have children, and Hashem, or at least unable to have a child with Sarah, and Hashem added a letter hey to his name, and from there came Yitzchak and the Jewish people. Hey lochem zera. Susan. The letter hey has provided for you seed. The deeper meaning is that it is through the letter hey that the Jewish people came about. We are only here because of the letter hey. Mm-hmm. The letter hey that was added to Avraham Avinu, that's what gave him the ability to have Yitzchak along with his wife Sarah. Hey lochem zera. That's a very, we'll call it a very cute observation. But what does it have to do with the storyline over here? Why would that be hinted to over here in the middle of this whole discussion about the grain and Paro and the Egyptians and Yosef?
Well, because Avram had the whole situation. He's in Sham with Sarah.
It is true they went to Egypt, but that was many, many years before the hay and Yitzchak being born. Okay, that's true. But what does that do with Avraham having a hay added to his name and Yitzchak being born?
Well, to me it points to these people Joseph is speaking to are God's people. So the hay represents that to me, the realization to Pharaoh that, and to Joseph, that these people indeed belong to God.
Okay. He was talking to the Egyptians. He wasn't talking to the Jewish people, but he is referencing the Jewish people. That is correct. He is definitely referencing the Jewish people. Remember, there was a famine that was supposed to be for 7 years. Yaakov came, and the famine ended after only 2 years, as we pointed out last week. And it was clear there was a terrible famine because the Nile had not overflown its banks in 2 years. And Yosef went over to the very low waters of the Nile because there was a drought, and walked over to the bank of the Nile, and the Nile rose up and overflowed its banks.
You said Yosef, you meant Yaakov.
I meant Yaakov. Thank you. Yaakov walked over to the Nile, and the Nile overflowed its banks, clearly showing that Yaakov had ended the famine. The famine ended because of Yaakov, who is because of Yitzchak, who is because of Avraham. Hey lochem zera, this seed is only here because of the hay that was given to Avraham Avinu, in order that he could produce Yitzchak, in order that he could produce Yaakov. More than that, remember we talked about this extensively back in Parashios Lech Lecha, Vayera, Chayesara, etc. We talked about this at great length, that the Jewish people should not be here, according to natural law. We only are here because of miracles. we should not be here. Abraham should not have been able to have a child. Sarah should not been able to have a child. Even after that child was born, he should have been slaughtered on Har HaMoriah for Akedat Yitzchak. And really, we should not be here. Everything happened because of either miracles or because of those great people rising to incredible challenges. Hey Lachem Zera, the Jewish people only exist because of supernatural and superhuman effort, supernatural events and superhuman effort. What is this hay that was added to Abraham's name? What does it represent? You'll recall when we learned about it back in Parshas Lech Lecha, which I don't hold you responsible for since that was about 3 years ago. But when we learned about it, we learned that Abraham, the numerical value of Abraham, the Gematria is 248, which corresponds to the limbs of the body, the bones of the body, the limbs of the body, that without the hay, it's only 243, which means that there were five parts of the body that Abraham did not have complete mastery over, that he was not able to control 100%. And by being given the hay, that symbolized that Abraham had now conquered every aspect of his physical being, that everything was under his control. And Abraham's existence, the spiritual side of him completely mastered the physical side of him. Now, when we say Abraham didn't have full control, you understand, of course, he had far more control than any of us do. But it wasn't to the point where it ended up the incredible superhuman effort that eventually took place. Abraham, before having the hay added to his name, for example, his eyes were not under full control, and by having the hay added, he became fully in his control. What does that mean? The Mefarshim, the commentaries explain that beforehand, like the rest of us, if Abraham were walking along and there was something that was incorrect for him to look at, he would have to close his eyes or turn his head away. Once he had the hay added to his name, then there could be something inappropriate directly in his line of sight and he would not see it. His spiritual side controlled his physical side to the extent that it was impossible for his eyes to see an improper sight, and his eyes would not be able to see that sight. It was a control that we are unable to appreciate. It's not possible for us to understand what that means. The hay represents, there are five things that represent, the two eyes, the two ears, and physical desire for illicit relationships. Those five parts of the body came under complete control. If you spoke Lashon Hara to Abraham Avinu, he would not be able to hear you talk. It's not that he would have to close his ears. He would not hear the words.
Wow.
You'll say, well then, how hard can it be then to avoid Lashon Hara? The reason why it's so difficult for me to not listen to Lashon Hara is because when someone tells me Lashon Hara, it's juicy and I want to hear it. So I'm listening. Well, if I couldn't hear it, if I could hear everything else and I couldn't hear the Lashon Hara, then it's a no-brainer. Then of course,
but he had to work to get to that point.
So the answer is he had to work to it. Because he worked to the point where Lashon Hara and other things of that nature were so abhorrent to him that his physical body became so controlled by his spiritual side that it literally repelled it repelled any sort of negative speech like that. It couldn't handle hearing that sort of talk. And if there would be that sort of talk would come his way, his ears would literally reject the sound. What does that mean? I mean, it doesn't seem to fit into anything aware of scientifically, but we know from the Medrash that that is what happened with Avraham Avinu. That is what the hay represents. Over here, excuse me, I'm just having trouble with my consequence, but it's not bothering me. I can still talk. It's just don't let it bother you. So, why is Yosef drawing attention to the hay over here? What does it have to do with the whole discussion? The Jewish people are now in Egypt, and we're going to be in Egypt for the next 210 years. Egypt was a place which was known for its decadence. It was an immoral place. Shtufei zima. They were
steeped.
That's right, in decadence. That was the country. Thank you. I'm right. Thank you. That was the culture they were now in. Yosef is including a measure of mussar, of admonishment, while dealing with the Egyptians. Hey lachem zera, I want you to understand, Egyptians, this famine was supposed to go on for another 5 years. You understand that? What's that?
Hey.
All right. Good. Another 5 years. Good. During those 5 years, many of you would have died of starvation. There was going to be terrible, terrible calamity over the next 5 years. Why did it end? It ended because of hay. Because the Jewish people represent the antithesis of the decadence that you represent. The Jewish people exist only because they represent the antithesis of the decadence that you represent. The Jewish people come from Avraham Avinu, who only deserved to have a child, Yitzchak, because he rejected your way of life. He rejected your culture. That is the only reason why he was able to have Yitzchak, which is the only reason why the Jewish people exist. Hey lachem zera. The zera, the seed, only comes because of the hay. Now, it wasn't only decadence with moral decadence, as we're familiar with. It was also decadence spiritually with their idolatry. We're not so familiar with that today because we don't have the Yetzirah, we don't have the inclination for idolatry anymore, and it's rare to see true idolatry, at least in this part of the world. But of course, as we know, that it was rampant, the paganism was rampant in their day.
Rabbi?
Yeah?
Is the kind of, if you will, worship or adulation that most people, let's say most Americans, have for, let's say, Hollywood or the government, or, is that a form of idolatry?
It seems that way, but it's not. We don't feel it the same way. It's not the same sort of thing as they have. And there was a real urge, the same urge that we all have, that if we are hungry and we pass a store or an establishment that has our favorite food, if it's a restaurant that we like, or if it's ice cream, or if it's pizza, or if it's, you know, whatever it is, or a bakery, something that we really like, and we pass that place and we're really hungry, so it's very difficult to avoid going in. And if we do go in, it's very difficult to buy only one thing. We'll spend more money than we should, and we eat more than we should. That same sort of urge, that's the urge they had for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry. It was an urge. It was a physical urge to worship. At any rate, the Egyptians were decadent in that way as well. Now, Paro protects the Kohanim. Paro protects the Kohanim. There are two questions over here. One is that when Paro chose to protect them, why didn't Yosef put up a fight? He could have. Yosef could have said, no, Paro. First of all, he could have used his power of persuasion over Paro. He was far and away, as we've seen before, a better chess player than anybody else on the face of the earth. He knew how to anticipate everybody else's moves and counter moves, and he had his way of manipulating and orchestrating a situation to get done things that he felt had to get done according to Hashem's plan. So he could have employed one of these methods to get Paro to come along with denying the Kohanim as well, just like everybody else, their portion. Or he could have told Paro that it's dangerous, you're going to cause trouble because you're going to cause an issue that the Kohanim are going to, if everybody else is going to want to be like the Kohanim, or perhaps you will give the Kohanim too much power, where Yosef was clearly trying to consolidate the power of Egypt in one man, in Paro, and now it becomes more diluted because the Kohanim now have power as well.
Maybe he was trying to pave the way for Levi.
Okay, so that's the second point, which is, the first point is, why did Yosef let it happen?
Yeah.
And the second point is, why did Hashem have it happen? So, why did Hashem have it happen is going to have to do with Levi. But first, let's address Yosef, and then we'll move on to Levi. Why did Yosef...
Which Paro was this at that time? What was his name? What was his...
I don't know.
You don't know?
Nope.
We don't know. We don't have...
No, I don't know. We don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yosef... Yosef had previous experience... Yes?
No, I was just going to suggest that maybe because he was giving his people a place to live and so on, that he didn't want to complain to Paro because Paro...
He was afraid then he would say, how could you then give the Jews preferential treatment if not, you're not going to let me give the Kohanim preferential treatment? Okay, good. Good. Yosef had previous experience with the Kohanim. This is not the first time that Yosef is dealing with the priests of Egypt. The first time Yosef dealt with the priests of Egypt is something which I did not mention to you back in Parashas Vayeshev, and that is when he had his episode of the run-in with the wife of Potiphar, and she attempted to frame him and accuse him of attempting to molest her, when in fact it was she who tried to get him involved. When she did this, Yosef was taken before a tribunal. There are different versions of the story depending on which medrash you look at, but no matter how you look at it, the ones who ultimately decided Yosef's fate were the Kohanim, were the priests. They were the ones who dealt with Yosef. In one version of the story, it was Potiphar who took Yosef before the Kohanim, and the Kohanim did not execute Yosef. That they allowed him to become a prisoner rather than to execute him. Another widespread version of the story is, and they could both be true, is that when the wife of Potiphar attempted to frame Yosef, so she didn't just, we know that what we read in the verses before, with the verses, what happened? Yosef was alone in the house, she feigned sickness when everybody else went to their idolatry, to their paganism, and then she grabbed Yosef. She grabbed Yosef's cloak. Yosef wriggled free of the cloak and ran out of the house. The Kohanim, and then she screamed and she said, "Yosef tried to attack me." She told her husband Potiphar what happened. Potiphar suspected his wife was lying. Knowing Yosef, and knowing his righteousness, knowing his wife's interest in Yosef, he suspected she was lying. So he approached the Kohanim to help, to do some investigative research and find out what actually happened. So the Medrash tells us that the wife of Potiphar, in order to prove her case, took egg whites and spread them over her clothing, the bed, etc., which would suggest that Yosef tried to molest her. The Kohanim showed that, now there was no way to tell by looking at it what it actually was, but the Kohanim were able to show by their own knowledge, they had some scientific knowledge, it probably did not come from scientific research, it probably came from their chachma, their wisdom that they had from previous generations, but they showed using a test with a match held against the white substance that it was actually egg yolk, proving that she had fabricated the story. Another point they made to Potiphar is, let's see whose clothing is torn. If it is her clothing that is torn, that would suggest that he attempted to molest her. If it is his clothing that is torn, that would seem to imply the reverse. The Kohanim, and those are just two examples, but it seems that the Kohanim used deduction and empirical evidence to show that it was she, the wife of Potiphar, who was guilty and not Yosef. And that spared Yosef's life. Yosef didn't forget this. So when Paro here suggests that the Kohanim should be given their own portion, Yosef does not attempt to stop that. He does owe the Kohanim for what they did him in the, for him in the past.
They put him in jail anyway, though, right?
Yeah, they had to do something because it was very embarrassing. It was shameful to Potiphar. What's he going to do? Announce it's going to go in the papers that the wife of Potiphar tried to get. You know what I mean? That's pretty. So there had to be some way to save face. The way to save face was not to execute him, but put him in jail.
Is this teaching us Hakarat HaTorah
that you're trying to... No, I wouldn't say that because it's not so explicit over here. And it was Paro who suggested sparing the, giving the Kohanim their portion. Mm-hmm. But Yosef didn't protest.
In the past, yeah. They've always referred to the word God. Why is it now said living God?
Does it say what?
Living God.
Where?
In 22... just towards the end, and he said, my children I have given Eretz Israel as an outright gift. Surely you who are children of the living God should graciously contribute a fifth. It's the word living that hit me just now.
This is not a translation of the verse.
22.
Yeah. I don't know why that's not a translation of the verse. That's one of the commentaries speaking.
Okay.
I don't know why I would use that phrase.
Behind it, it says Moshe's Hakim.
Yeah, not sure why. But now there was another reason why Yosef did not protest over here, and we'll end with this point, that as was already pointed out, that this ended up being good for the Jewish people. Yosef had not planned this. It was Paro who planned this, but clearly Hashem put the idea on Paro's mind. Because this way, when the Jews started to become enslaved, there was a natural exception to slavery in Egypt. In Egypt, it had already been built into the system that whenever there are slaves, there is a priest class, the priestly class, that is exempt from the slavery. And so here, when the pagan Kohanim were exempt, when the Jewish people became slaves, the tribe of Levi, who were the priestly tribe, the Kohanim of course come from Levi, they were exempt as well. Which is why, as Rashi points out to us later on in Parshas Va'era, that Moshe and Aaron were able to come and go to Paro at will. They weren't busy, Rashi points it out in Parshas Shmos, actually. They weren't part of the slaves. Had they been part of the slaves, they wouldn't have been able to go visit with Paro whenever they chose because they'd have to be working. And yet they seem to have free reign to be able to walk around Egypt. Moshe and Aaron, coming from the tribe of Levi, were exempt. This helped preserve the Jewish people because we know that once we left Egypt, it was the tribe of Levi that had adhered most closely to Hashem, more than all the other tribes. They're the ones who had given their children circumcision while in Egypt, as opposed to the rest of the Jewish people, etc. The tribe of Levi were the closest. The reason why they were able to be the closest to Hashem is because they were exempt from the slavery. There is another part of this, which is that later on we're going to find, and we know this, that the Jewish people grew in numbers exponentially. That they were having incredible amount of children per pregnancy, as we'll see later on in Parashat Shmos. It seems that this bracha did not apply to the tribe of Levi, because since Levi wasn't working, they did not have that bracha, that blessing, in return. It was only the rest of the Jewish people. Levi is traditionally the smallest of the tribes, as we will see as we move along in B'chumash.
Yeah.
Right, in this past week's parashah, as we see that they were relatively small.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.